It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a music writer gives us his picks for must-see music festivals in Wisconsin this summer.
First, President Trump made good on a campaign promise to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement today after keeping the public in suspense all week about whether he'd abandon the landmark deal aimed at targeting climate change. He announced his decision. Here's a listen.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord Thank you. But begin negotiations to re-enter either the Paris Accord or in really entirely new transaction on terms that are fair to the United States, its businesses, its workers, its people, its taxpayers.
The United States is now part of a trio of nations that has rejected the Paris plan. The only other countries who have not signed on are Syria and Nicaragua. There are more than 190 other countries that have signed on to the deal, and many of those countries have shown disappointment in the United States' decision to pull out.
Alana Shore is a congressional reporter at Politico. She also focuses on energy and climate. She joins us now to tell us about some of the impact of the decision. Alana, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, President Trump laid out what he said was an unfair deal, the Paris Climate Agreement. Why did he say it was unfair to the United States?
Well, there were a lot of questionable factual assumptions in the president's speech, which seemed to boil down to the Paris Agreement won't do enough and it transfers wealth away from American fossil fuel producers. In fact, a lot of reputable projections show that the U.S. was already on track to meet the Paris deal's commitments just based on existing market-infused transitions away from coal and towards natural gas, which a lot of environmentalists hate. So the reality is fairly different from what the president outlined.
And he also talked about India and China being able to boost coal production, use of coal over the years, essentially saying we're doing the work, they're getting to increase emissions of carbon over the next bunch of years. What do you make of that argument?
Well, that's not also technically true. India and China, you know, have committed to their own targets. The way the Paris deal works is each country basically crafts its own plan to achieve its emissions reduction. So it might be true, you know, in a vacuum that India and China's internally written plan is less stringent than what the Obama administration wrote. But to say they can just continue with business as usual is not true.
So what is the impact of the president pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord? What does it mean for what we can do in the United States?
Well, it's symbolically hugely important and substantively not so important. And let me explain why that is. The Obama administration played a huge role in even making the Paris deal happen, was a tremendous leader. At a certain point, it was thought that, you know, that many nations couldn't even reach a deal to all fight climate change on this level. So for the U.S. to be getting out now after the previous president did so much to make it happen, it sends a really questionable signal diplomatically to a lot of the nations that we were involved in. You know, your host mentioned that the only two nations that haven't signed on are Syria and Nicaragua, but Nicaragua didn't sign on because they thought it didn't go far enough. So in truth, we're really only in the company of Syria at this point. And why it's substantively less important, however, is that built into the Paris deal was a provision that said you couldn't really formally exit for 4 years. So funny enough, the official departure from Paris is actually scheduled for the day after Election Day 2020. So listeners may go, huh, well, what if President Trump loses re-election? What happens then? And I don't think a lot of people know for sure.
And he said, hey, we are going to start renegotiating, maybe to come back in to the current deal or some kind of alternative deal. What would that mean? What would be involved in starting, I guess, from scratch?
Let's be honest, this deal has already been signed by now, I guess, more than 189 nations. And, you know, the State Department staffing by the Trump administration is just not up to snuff for where you would need to be to start this kind of a renegotiation. I have a hard time believing that will happen.
Talking to Alana Shore, writer for Politico. She covers Congress and energy and the climate, looking at President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, what that could mean. Here's another listen to a little bit of this speech. The president saying the accords were designed to benefit other countries' economies. Here's a listen.
This agreement is less about the climate and more about other countries gaining a financial advantage over the United States.
And this is consistent with how the president has talked about trade deals as well. Not so much looking at an overall win-win for other sides, but saying the United States loses because these reportedly negotiated deals in the first place. What do you make of this overall message on trade and climate?
Well, look, I think this message politically definitely appeals to the blue-collar working-class folks who came out for President Trump on Election Day. But, you know, at a certain point, the president said, I'm paraphrasing here a bit, but he said, I was elected to represent Pittsburgh, not Paris. And the mayor of Pittsburgh immediately started firing back on Twitter, saying, actually, you know, Hillary Clinton won our city, and we fully support the goals of the Paris Accord, which is true. The city has its own green climate program. So, you know, it's important for us to remember that the message appeals to a lot of the president's base, but it's not correct to say that all of these, you know, former fossil fuel and industrial dominated towns are cheering today.
What have we seen from Congress this week leading up to this decision? I think people were assuming that this was the decision the president was going to make to drop out. So what have we seen from members of Congress on both sides?
Well, it's largely predictable in what you would expect. Most Republicans, except for a handful of House Republicans who represent, you know, swing areas in places like Florida, which is hugely at risk due to sea level rise, most Republicans are you know, praising the president, and most Democrats are criticizing the president. What I found most interesting was Heidi Heitkamp, who is a senator from North Dakota, very close to her home state's oil industry, and consistently at odds with the environmental left because of that, said she thought it was a bad decision. And the reason why she said pulling out of Paris is a bad idea is what I talked about earlier on the diplomacy angle. I mean, this is a super fossil fuel-friendly Democrat who still likes natural gas, which the Paris Agreement would have supported, who likes things like coal capture and sequestration, basically technology to get the carbon out of coal, which she believes can't happen if the U.S., you know, just leaves the table. So that's a really significant harbinger for how this will play out.
And on that diplomatic front, you have China, which once rejected the idea of climate change as a way for industrial democracies to restrict Chinese growth. Well, now President Trump has said that at one point global warming was a Chinese hoax to restrict American growth. Now people are pointing toward China as maybe a global leader on climate change, already talking to leaders of Europe to try to all stay on board with the Paris Climate Accord. What does this do to the international diplomatic scene?
Well, it's not going to do positive things largely across the board. I mean, China and the U.S. have an extremely complicated relationship, of which this is one piece. So I am hesitant to say this would at all be, you know, formatively negative. But, you know, what it does is it sends the signal about the Trump administration that it's probably serious about things like renegotiating NAFTA and other trade deals. You know, there was a real open question, how much of this does the president mean? And today, again, symbolically says, he means most of it.
And then could there be a domino effect here? The United States drops out of Paris. Were there other countries kind of waiting for a first shoe to drop and then maybe they'll follow suit?
I don't believe that's really the case. This was sort of a one-off among the signatories of the Paris deal. And in fact, I think you're seeing the EU's leaders as well respond to this by reaffirming their commitment to it.
And up till now, we've seen President Trump back away from some of what President Obama had done in terms of energy and environmental policy to meet commitments under the Paris Accord. Are we expecting to see more movement in that direction?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think, you know, Congress is out of session today. So I think we're just going to have to wait and see sort of how legislators continue to respond.
We'll leave it there for now. Alana, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Alana Shore is a congressional reporter at Politico. She's also covered energy and the climate. She joined us to talk about President Trump's decision, his announcement this afternoon, to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, a deal that 190 other countries signed on to fight climate change.
Coming up, a music writer says there's good reason to get excited about the music festivals happening in Wisconsin this summer. Stay with us on Central Time. Summer's here, and for a lot of people, that means summer music festivals. From country to hip-hop to bluegrass, Wisconsin has been upping its summer music festival game, and now there's something for just about every musical taste.
Piet Levy joins us now, music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you wrote a piece lately on 10 great festivals other than Summerfest to check out in Wisconsin. But let's start with the big kid, Summerfest. 50th year, I understand, of the festival. Who are some of the big name acts you're watching for this year?
Yeah, 50th year. It's incredible. And when you mentioned something for everybody, that's exactly what Summerfest has. What I'm most excited about is on the last day, they have something called the Outlaw Music Festival, which will be a 9-hour event in the American Family Insurance Amphitheater, formerly known as the Marcus Amphitheater. And this is an incredible lineup that ranges from Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats, kind of an emerging soul roots rock band. They've got Jason Isbell on that bill, Sheryl Crow, Bob Dylan, and Willie Nelson will also be there. So really pumped about that. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interesting collaborations. And yeah, 9 hours, really good lineup there.
Yeah, Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan have collaborated back in the 90s. Here's a little bit of their song, Heartland.
There's a home place under fire tonight in the heartland. With a well where the water's so bitter nobody can drink. Ain't no way.
So we just heard Bob there, but two distinctive voices, Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan. Are you hoping they'll be up there performing together?
I hope so. Bob Dylan is, you know, notoriously unpredictable, so it's hard to say. But Willie Nelson frequently does on-stage collaborations at shows. His last shows in Milwaukee included one with Kris Kristofferson, one with late Merle Haggard. When he did Farm Aid in Milwaukee several years ago, there were multiple times he kind of popped in for sets. So I expect the same. If not with Dylan himself, then probably with Sheryl Crow and Jason Isbell. And his son, Lucas Nelson, is also playing that day, so I bet there'll be a father-son collaboration.
So that's some of the big names. How about a local act you're excited to see at Summerfest?
What I really love is that there are a lot of local bands playing at Summerfest, and this year Summerfest has made more of a concerted effort to designate some as official headliners, which they haven't done too frequently in the past. And this year there's actually two bands that will have final headlining slots that are from Milwaukee or have Milwaukee ties. One of them is a rapper named Ishtar, who's really kind of blowing up right now in the local scene. He has several million streams for his hits. He's got kind of party hip hop, not too social. Conscious or serious, but it's definitely got a lot of fun to it. It's got this kind of EDM vibe to it, and he's doing really well here. He even is doing some acting. He was recently cast in a movie opposite Matthew McConaughey called White Boy Rick that'll be coming out in January. So there's a hip-hop resurgence happening in Milwaukee, and he's leading the pack, and he'll get a 10 p.m. slot on July 4th.
Let's give a listen to Ishtar. This is Breaking Hearts.
Change about the hour, Buddha saw what plans, super spacey, feeling out of acting, so it's strange to all the cowards, Kawasaki, copping that for Zari, cannons, 20 cop to Aldi, young mind on a target, CCM full of
stars. Ishtar there, a local act headlining at Summerfest. Well, I want to move out to the rest of the state. Let's go to Eau Claire for the Justin Vernon curated festival, Claire's, I'm trying to say it the way it's spelled. It's the third year of
it's
this.
It's Eau Claire, yeah.
I know. I'm just trying to, make it a little distinctive there. So the third year of the festival, what stands out to you this time around?
Well, I think that festival stands out, period. It's very different from any other festival that I really know about in the sense that it's not really so much a festival as it almost feels like a musical retreat. There's a lot of really interesting kind of collaborations there, special performances there. There's a lot of immersive kind of art pieces and things on the ground. Last year, I sat in on a book reading in a mobile hotel room with like three other people. It's very different, but it's very interesting. This year, they've got some, it's probably their biggest lineup. Yeah, they have Chance a rapper. Paul Simon's going to be doing a set with Y Music. Bon Iver will be there, but they're going to actually be playing songs with John Prine for kind of a one-time-only performance, playing some of Prine's songs. And I'm really pumped about Sylvan Esso, which is a duo from North Carolina, but they have Milwaukee ties. Nick Sanborn and Amelia Meath actually met at the Cactus Club in Milwaukee when they were in separate acts, and they just kind of bonded, became close friends, and now Sylvan Esso is really kind of blowing up and playing all over the world.
Let's give a listen to Sylvan Esso. This is Die Young. They're playing at the Eau Claire Festival. So a lot of variety at the Eau Claire Festival. And you mentioned some collaborations. That's kind of a feature, kind of one-of-a-kind things that you're not going to see. You probably won't see on an album anytime soon.
Yeah, absolutely not. And they actually, this year, they're going to have kind of a team of rotating musicians who will do a lot of collaborations with other artists. I think Jenny Lewis is going to be one of those artists. So there'll be a lot of performances there that you'll only get to see at Eau Claire. It's a very special place.
Let's go to another Eau Claire festival now, Blue Ox Music Festival. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, one's coming up quick. June 8th is when it starts. And that started a few years ago, and you know, there's really a lot of love for kind of bluegrass in the States. There's bands like Trampled by Turtles from Minnesota, which has gotten to the level in Milwaukee where they can play 2,500-seat theater like the Riverside Theater, and Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, which is actually one of the headlining acts at Summerfest. They also have a prime slot at the Eau Claire Festival. They are from Stevens Point, but have some members in Milwaukee. But the festival is broadened from bluegrass, Drive-By Truckers, which had an excellent album that came out last year, lots of critical acclaim. They're playing this festival. Punch Brothers is playing as well. And Dead Horses is a Milwaukee group that I really love. We had a feature, the Wisconsin Bands to Watch for 2017, and Dead Horses has been touring really aggressively, have an excellent album called Cartoon Moon they're touring behind, and they've got a nice slot at this festival, much deserved.
Punch Brothers has that fella on that public radio show now, and also Dead Horses I wanted to give a listen to.
Burning bush in the desert night, will you share your
Dead Horses. They're also playing at the Simply Folk Party coming up later this week. Piet, let's go on now from Eau Claire. A lot going on there, I know. You wrote in your piece a lot of great country music festivals going on around the state. Give us a rundown.
Yeah, Wisconsin is basically Country Fest Mecca. There's actually a fest called Country Fest to start with, which is probably of the ones to pick from. I think that's kind of the heaviest hitter this year. It's got Eric Church, who did a show at Milwaukee in April. He went on well past midnight. He's just an incredible live performer. Blake Shelton, Thomas Rhett, Alabama are some of the big names there. But you've also got Country Jam USA, which is actually in Eau Claire. Eau Claire has another festival, and Country Jam USA will be a big one there. You've also got Country Thunder in Twin Lakes, Country on the River in Prairie du Chien. That one will have Chris Stapleton, his only headlining set in Wisconsin this summer. And the Hodog Country Festival is a little bit of a smaller event, but it's got a long history. It's celebrating 40 years. Summerfest celebrating 50 years, Hodog celebrating 40 years, and they've got Little Big Town among the big acts, and also Brandi Clark, who I just absolutely love. I think she's one of Nashville's sharpest and smartest and most emotional songwriters right now.
Yeah, you gave us a heads up about Brandi Clark. Want to give her a listen, the track Get High.
Smoke so sweet, fills the air. She maybe ought to crack a window. All she can do is stare at the paint that's been peeling off of the wall.
Brandi Clark there. We're talking about summer music festivals with Piet Levy. A lot going on around the state. And I saw, I can't remember which festival, the Oak Ridge Boys are still around, and they're playing at one of these festivals, Piet.
Yep, they're playing at the Hodog Country Festival. That's right, still around. They're celebrating 70th anniversary. Not all, you know, the members in the lineup, though, haven't been around for 70 years, but they've been around since 73. It's the most accomplished lineup.
So the lineup we've heard on the radio is still together, the lineup that we're familiar with.
Yep, still together. Absolutely.
So a lot of country going on. Let's get into some rock now. There's some metal to be seen in Wisconsin, Rock USA and Oshkosh. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. It's going to be a really heavy kind of metal hard rock lineup and some big names there. You've got Korn, you've got Megadeth, Lamb of God, Avenged Sevenfold, Slayer. The big news for this, though, is that Ozzy Osbourne's headlining. He was running around with Black Sabbath. They are now officially done. Now he's going back to touring solo. But what's special about this is he's reuniting with his celebrated lead guitarist, Zakk Wylde, who does his own stuff as well. They kind of come together here and there, and this is their first show together at Rock USA in several years, first show ever together in several years. We'll be at Rock USA. It's happening July 13th to the 15th in Oshkosh.
So Ozzy without Black Sabbath now, but that's a big show. And then this is a big deal, and less with the big name acts, I think, but the Mile of Music in Appleton. Keep hearing about that. It seems like it's getting bigger every year.
Yeah, this is the fifth year that's happening. It was co-founded by Corey Chisel, who's a Grammy-nominated artist from Appleton. And this is a very unique festival. It spans, this year it's going to be spanning across 70 venues. There'll be 230 acts on the bill, or more than 230 acts. They'll be playing more than 900 sets. And they're playing within a mile-long concentration downtown in Appleton from August 3rd to the 6th. You know, there's a lot of opportunities for discovery here. San Fermin is playing a classical indie rock hybrid that I really like. Baroque pop artist Diane Coffey. J.C. Brooks is a soul singer from Chicago. Tenement. I love Tenement. It's a punk band that Iggy Pop really loves. They're from Wisconsin. What's really special about this festival, though, is that all these sets, all these, you know, shows, everything's free. All the shows are free. There's a kind of an upgrade charge you can do which gets you some perks, but you can just go to this festival. You don't have to pay anything to see a lot of great music.
Here's a little taste of San Fermin. The track is Bride. San Fermin playing at Mile of Music at Appleton. And finally, a hip-hop, electronic dance music, EDM-leaning festival, Somerset, as we wrap up, Piet.
Yeah, Somerset is happening in Somerset, Wisconsin, August 11th to the 13th. And, yeah, this is kind of the, over the last few years, the festival to go to for people who really love hip-hop, really love EDM. You know, this is just kind of the party hard festival. It's kind of the Lollapalooza or Coachella of Wisconsin, essentially. This year, some of the bigger names include Zed's Dead, Zed and Grizz, among the electronic artists. But Run the Jewels, I'm really pumped that Run the Jewels is playing there because this is a hip-hop duo that's just gotten a lot of praise, well-deserved. It's really kind of up at the peak of the hip-hop crop right now, or the pile, I guess. So, yeah, the fact that they're playing this festival is definitely a really good get.
Piet, thanks a lot for the whirlwind tour of summer festivals. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Get more information at jsonline.com/music.
That's Piet Levy, music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we've got his article on music festivals linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at how things like nutrition and housing in the first 5 years of a child's life can impact achievement down the road. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in many urban neighborhoods, retail food options can be scarce, and people without a car may travel miles for fresh meat and produce. Residents of the Walker's Point neighborhood in Milwaukee have been trying to attract a grocery store to their area for years, and their efforts are finally paying off. We hear how they came together to make it happen.
First, the earliest years of a child's life can be some of the most crucial. The human brain develops at the fastest rate between the ages of birth and 3 years old. Research shows that factors like nutrition and education in a child's developmental years have an impact on achievement far down the road.
A summit being held today at UW-Madison is bringing experts together from 50 counties around the state to look more closely at those factors. The summit, called Prenatal to Five, will look at what people can do to nurture brain development in a child's early years to narrow what many people call the achievement gap between kids from different backgrounds.
Janine Dilworth-Bart joins us now to tell us more. She's the chair of the summit and also chair of the Department of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Janine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why focus on these first 5 years of life?
Wow. So those first 5 years, so much is going on in a child's life. All of the really critical neural connections are happening. Developing those early relationships with caregivers and then eventually friends. Also, just it sets the foundation for who that child is going to be.
And what is exactly going on in the brain that makes these first 5 years so important?
So what's going on is that as a child is developing in utero, the brain is making neural connections. All those neurons are connecting. And then as a child is born, those connections still continue. They still continue to be made. And there's a lot of interaction with the environment that allow those connections to continue. So the more enriching the environment, the more enriched the brain.
And how can optimizing brain development help a child all the way through adulthood? It seems like that's a lot to ask of those first 5 years.
It is a lot to ask. Those first 5 years are really important. That time, even prenatally, it's very important. And so what happens in that early environment is that we are interacting with people. We are learning how to negotiate our environments, how to negotiate our different relationships with other people. And what we're doing is setting a stage for the person that we're going to become. And so it's not that everything stops at five. It's that when what we start at five, or we start in that prenatal period up through early childhood, we're really creating an opportunity for children to get the best out of their lives as they can.
And you have this prenatal to five summit going on in Madison today. Can you tell us a little bit about the backstory there? How did that come about?
So the summit is actually tomorrow.
There's another
summit going on today that is elevating the profession of early childhood or early childhood professionals. And I was attending that as well. So the backstory on the summit is that in 2015, my dean of the School of Human Ecology, she came to me and she gave me an assignment. And she said, you know, we have this wonderful preschool lab and it's about to be 100 years old. So what can we do to reimagine what this preschool lab is going to be? And so what we did is we met with numerous people, parents, early educators, researchers, students, childcare providers across the community. We met with them and said, well, you know, what kinds of things do you think we should be doing? And it very quickly became clear that this was so much bigger than us. This was a bigger effort. There was already so much going on in our community, and we wanted to be a part of what was already happening. So we met up with other schools and colleges, including education, and we quickly realized that what was starting out as a preschool lab effort became this growing prenatal to five initiative.
So a lot of listening going on there. What kinds of things did you hear from people about what kinds of approaches and disciplines they wanted to be part of this effort?
Well, you know, we wanted, what we heard was that we wanted thought leaders. And I was like, so what's a thought leader? Because that sounds sort of like a non-term. But we wanted people who were working directly with children. Who were dedicated to working with families. So the people who will be coming to the summit come from any number of fields. They come from medicine, public health, early childhood education, human development, psychology, any number of fields that are going to be represented. And so that's what we heard, is that what we need is everyone in, a community effort to really address these critical issues.
We're talking right now with Janine Dilworth-Bart. She's the chair of the Prenatal to Five Summit, which will be held tomorrow at UW-Madison. And we're looking at how future outcomes can be improved upon by focusing on the first 5 years of a child's life, and in particular in brain development. And Janine, one of the biggest problems that educators are trying to address right now is what's known as the achievement gap. You are preferring a different term. We'll get to that in a moment.
Okay.
But how can brain development and focusing in on that possibly improve something like that disparity?
Well, getting back to this idea that we're setting the stage. We're setting the stage for healthy, productive lives for children. And so if you are developing in a context where there's insufficient food, where your health care needs and your health is not cared for, where you don't have housing stability, it makes it really hard to learn. it makes it really difficult to parent. And so focusing on this earliest part of a child's life, and making sure that all of those needs are met, it's critical to really addressing these underlying issues, these things that we call a gap, that we call disparities. You know, those differences, they do exist, and they exist because of really issues that are sometimes, oftentimes, structural in our society.
So you're talking about things like housing and parenting and nutrition and language, and these all are apparently a piece of what it takes to raise a healthy child with a healthy brain that's developing.
Exactly.
So I can see why you would need that community-style approach. How do you go about, how will you go about bringing all those pieces together?
So that's the exciting thing about the summit. So as university scholars, we decided, you know what, we need to listen and know what's going on in our state. And so with the summit, people will come in, and our goal is to hear, is to learn what's going on out in our furthest most counties, what's going on in our tribal nations. And as we hear what people need, what they're currently doing, that's when I could say, oh, okay, I have expertise in a certain area that maybe I can contribute in my role as a professor of human development and family studies. But there are other things that it might occur to me, well, I don't have that expertise, but let's create a network. Let's create a prenatal to five network that is statewide, that reaches all the corners of the state, that reaches all of our tribal nations, that really brings together all of those resources.
And I want to stop and address this term achievement gap, because we hear it a lot. We do a lot of interviews on the show, and that's the term that tends to be used. You prefer the term education debt. Can you tell us why?
Yeah, I would like to take credit for that term, but I can't. It's one of our professors here at UW-Madison, Gloria Ladson-Billings. And when we talk about achievement gap, what it bestows a sense of blame on a child that there's something wrong with them. There's a deficit in them, as opposed to recognizing that we have a responsibility as members of a society to help our children succeed. And so as I thought about this term, achievement gap, unfortunately, oftentimes it's used, and what it boils down to is that Black and brown kids just don't do well. And they are somehow inherently deficient. And that's not the overt intention of that term, but that's often how that term, that's the undercurrent of that term. But education debt, it flips the responsibility away from a child who is an infant, you know, going through infancy and toddlerhood, who doesn't have all of that agency. And it flips the responsibility back to us, back to the wider society.
There has been starting to be some new attention paid to this period of life, 0 to 5, and in particular, the brain development. And we've talked about that on this program as well, but is there evidence out there already that by focusing in on brain development and all of these factors that come together to help a healthy child with a healthy brain, is there data that this can help close the education debt, or you know, the achievement gap?
Or these disparities in educational outcomes. Yeah, so there's growing evidence out there that if we really focus on making sure that our children at their earliest stages of life have their needs met, and then more than just have their needs met, but also have opportunities for enrichment, to thrive, to have rich language interactions, that those things are related to better academic outcomes, better socio-emotional outcomes. But it's also important to keep in mind that this development happens in a context. So there's a wider context that all of these things happen in. So I can talk to my child, I can hug my child and nurture my child, but my child also needs to live in an environment that's safe and enriching and stable.
We're talking right now with Janine Dilworth-Bard in studio. She's the chair of the Prenatal to Five Summit being held at UW-Madison. And we're looking right now at how future outcomes can be improved by focusing on the first 5 years of a child's life.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is out there in your community? Do you see a local effort to focus on these early years, prenatal to five, to help kids? Do you work in early childhood education? Tell us what you do, what you see with the kids you work with if you are in the schools. What would you like to see focused on before a kid comes to school? Do you see these things like not just education, but also housing, nutrition, making a difference in kids' performances? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation now with Janine Dilworth-Bart. She's the chair of the Prenatal to Five Summit, which is being held at UW-Madison. And we're looking at what resources in the first 5 years of a child's life lead to healthy brain development and ultimately to later success.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest or your thoughts on this topic. Do you work in this field? Do you work with kids, especially kids prenatal up to five, prenatal care up to five or beyond? What do you see making a difference for things like success in school? What do you think that individuals and communities can do to improve things, not just when it comes to education, but housing, nutrition, things like that? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Mary on the line with us in Madison. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A wonderful topic. I was just going to ask about the summit and addressing the nutritional aspects, parents' choices for the proper nutrition for your child, especially, you know, at prenatal stage and through infancy, in the growing number of concerns that parents have on being able to provide good nutritional choices for their children due to the mislabeling of foods, the chemicals in foods, and being in certain areas where being able to afford the proper nutrition for your child.
Mary, thanks so much for that call. And what do you say to that, Jenny? What options are there and some of the obstacles that parents can run into?
Well, I think that there can be many obstacles. Food deserts are a very real issue. I live over close to the southwest side of Madison, and I am very thankful that I have the availability of a car, and I have the availability of a bus line, because I can feed my kids, and I can get to the grocery store and relatively easily find them some a wide selection of fruits and vegetables to eat. And so there's absolutely an issue with the availability of and easy access to food in our communities. So one thing that parents can do, so we know that our children should be eating a wide variety of plant-based foods. A plant-based diet is turning out to be the healthiest diet for our children and for, well, all humans. And so oftentimes eating those fresh vegetables, people are afraid to get them because they'll go bad. Well, there's the frozen vegetable option, which is just as healthy and it lasts a little bit longer. But I do agree with Mary that there are some very distinct issues around nutrition, around being able to access healthy food. And really a big part of that is that we have this whole structural issue of availability of markets, but also availability of public transportation.
Great. Well, Mary, thank you so much for that question. Appreciate it. And we'll move next to Cynthia joining us in Madison. Cynthia, hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Hi,
sure.
Janine.
Hi.
It's a wonderful summit. I'm really looking forward to attending it. And I had a question about the role of high-quality early child care, especially in reducing some of the racial disparities we see in Dane County and also across the state. What kind of concrete policies can we look to make sure that high-quality nurturing child care is available to all children in our community?
Cynthia, thank you for that. And Janine?
That is a wonderful question, and I thank Cynthia for asking it. You know, we really need to rethink how we conceptualize, how we talk about what early child care is. Our early child care providers, they're professionals. They are skilled professionals that help our children develop into healthy human beings. And so their role is absolutely critical. Their role is essential. They provide meaningful supports, not only to children, but to families. I can say, being a transplant from the East Coast, that in the day-to-day functioning of my life, when I had an issue with my two small kids, and I couldn't get my mother on the phone, I would talk to my child care provider and say, well, how do I get my kid to eat those healthy fruits and vegetables that I've gotten for them at the grocery store? And so that role of early child care really cannot be overstated. It's essential as a support. And I think that really one of the things that, if I were to imagine what would come out of our summit tomorrow, is a very frank, a very real discussion about how do we elevate this profession.
We're talking right now with Janine Dilworth-Bart, Chair of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, talking about what factors in the first 5 years of a child's life can lead to later success and how to make sure those factors come into play successfully for kids and help their brains develop well. And we'll take another call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we have Jen with us next, calling from Madison. Jen, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have three primary questions, and I'm going to try and, like, be concise and then try and take the answer off the air. I'm wondering if the guest can talk a little bit about what the holdup is in terms of funding and policymaking that prioritizes reactive programming, like incarceration, versus proactive programming, like Head Start, particularly when statistics show that early, intensive, resource-rich programming directly correlates to better outcomes. Secondly, I'm wondering what she has to think, you know, what her thoughts are on cultural appropriation of education. I have worked in several educational settings, as well as my spouse is a former school teacher in Chicago, and oftentimes found that for individuals of color, the idea of engaging in educational programming or gifted programs was seen as being culturally removed or selling out.
And Jen, I'm going to jump in there because we're running short of time. I just want to make sure we've got time for our guest to respond, at least to the first two. So Janine, she was mentioning there different kinds of what she called programming and also cultural appropriation. What do you say?
So I'll start with the second question, because I think this is a this is an interesting one, because I will say, as an African-American myself, this idea of education being culturally devalued is something that I just can't relate to. And I think that there's a way to flip that and to think in terms of, if your neighborhood is unsafe, if you're hungry, if your housing is unstable, if you have all of these stressors going on in your life, it's really hard to focus on education. And so that's one of the things that I would counter with, is that education is incredibly important as a means out of tough situations in a lot of lower income, not just African American or Black and Brown communities, but really in all communities. And this idea of the funding holdup, I wish I had an answer to that, because the science is pretty solid that all of these investments are in the earliest part of life, they are, they're worth it. The returns are amazing. You know, if I could buy a stock that would give me a return of 7 to 10% or 12%, I would be thrilled. And that's what investment in early childhood, and in prenatal to five, that's what that gives us.
And Janine, we're just about out of time, but 20 seconds. Any final takeaways for parents who want to take small steps to ensure their child's achievement and health at home?
The favorite thing that I like to tell parents when I talk to them is go to sleep. So I know that's a little bit off topic, but I am a big fan of going to bed. And so that is a recommendation that I would give. And after that, I would like to say that the story is not written for our children. So we're talking about prenatal to five tomorrow. However, there's all that time after five that we'll focus on as well.
Janine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Janine Dilworth-Bart, chair of the Prenatal 5 Summit starting tomorrow in Madison, also chair of the Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, talking about early brain development.
If you've ever wanted to be in the middle of Wisconsin, like not in a vague way, but actually right spot on in the middle, the state legislature is looking to help you out.
And who among us hasn't wanted to be
in
the middle of Wisconsin? Well, lawmakers on the state's budget committee approved funding for a landmark at its geographic center of Wisconsin, which is near the city of Pittsville in Wood County.
And I just eyeballed a map of Wisconsin. That looks about right to me. It's right there in the middle, just a little west of Stevens Point, a little bit south of Marshfield.
And Pittsville was recognized as the geographical center of Wisconsin by Governor Walter Kohler in 1952, and lawmakers are setting aside something like $7,500 to make a bigger deal out of this place.
Now, I haven't been to Pittsville, but I think now once this thing is up, I will want to go there. I mean, because I think it'd be kind of cool to be photographed next to the new signage. And B, it's like, you know, staying in the four corners of those states out west out there.
Yeah, I wonder what the view is like there.
I have no idea. Yeah, so
maybe
we've got to, I think, when these things go up, Central Time, live, remote, we'll be stuck right there in the middle of Wisconsin. You with me?
I'm there. Yeah, I'm absolutely there. Who hasn't wanted to be in the center? You're right. Maybe this will provide us a unique perspective about Wisconsin, the state in which we live.
This is Central Time.